This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I'm talking to Gary Latchman about his book, his latest book, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. Now, I want to say first off, right off the bat, this is not a particularly political conversation. It's more a conversation about history and observations of how people are persuaded one way or the other. It is not it's not meant as a decisive sort of divisive conversation here, as you'll see. So just because we've mentioned Trump, don't think that this is a political-oriented conversation. It is definitely not. It is observations and stuff that we go back through all kinds of different things that have inspired different aspects of the political spectrum, things that kind of work underneath, these sort of occult forces, hence the magic and power aspect. It's really fascinating. It's a great book. And, of course, everyone's opinions are their own. So, you know, let's keep it that way. I'm going to read Gary's bio here because it's really fascinating. Gary Latchman is the author of many books on consciousness, culture, and the Western esoteric tradition, including The Secret Teachers of the Western World, Beyond the Robot, A Secret History of Consciousness, which I highly recommend. That one was fantastic. I haven't read some of these other ones yet. And Politics and the Occult. He writes for several journals in the U.S. and U.K. and lectures on his work in the United States, U.K. and Europe. His books have been translated into more than a dozen languages, and he is an assistant professor in transformative studies at the California Institute of Integral Studies. A founding member of the rock group Blondie, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006. So, a lot of this conversation is about positive thinking. It's about, we talk about Nazis. We talk about just all kinds of stuff that goes into this whole world situation we're in now. So I hope you find this interesting. And without any further ado, here's my conversation with Gary. Hello, Gary. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
And you have quite the catalog of books you've written. Do you even know how many you've written at this point?
I think it's about 20, and I edited one, so it's around 21.
Okay, all right. And before that, you were a founding member of Blondie as well.
Well, that was sometime before. In the 70s. Then I was in music up until about the early 80s, and then dropped out of that and sort of had a career in the real world to some extent in academia, and then also working at a metaphysical bookstore. Mm-hmm. But in the mid-90s, I moved to London, and since then, since 96, I've been a full-time writer.
Okay. And a lot of the stuff is on consciousness and sort of like the history of people like Crowley and Jung and stuff like that.
Yes, it's sort of what you it's kind of the evolution of consciousness and sort of looking at what we sort of call the Western esoteric or the Western Hermetic tradition, this kind of counterculture that runs through the West.
And your new book is called Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. And I wasn't totally sure what to expect of this. It's really interesting the way you break this down. Do you want to give people an idea of what the book is?
Well, the book is about a kind of strange occult politics that seems to have come into view in recent times surrounding Trump's election and also events in Russia. And I had 10 years ago, a book of mine called Politics and the Occult had come out. And in that book, it's sort of a general overview of this idea that throughout history at different times, certain ideas that we would consider sort of occult or mystical had an influence on the politics of the time. And likewise, politicians various times had an interest in these sorts of ideas. And sort of the main kind of thrust of that book was to show that although there's been a lot of things said about this relationship between any kind of occult politics and sort of far right or extreme right politics. Any kind of relationship between the occult and politics has generally been seen as something happening on the far right. And while that's true, there is quite a bit of that. It's not only that. And you can find what I call a kind of progressive occult politics if you look for it. And so that book was sort of showing that if you're interested in the occult and you're interested in politics, you don't have to necessarily be on the far right and be a fascist. But what seemed to be happening in the last couple years is that there has been kind of a resurgence of a sort of kind of occult politics on the far right. And this came to light through some of the publicity around the alt-right and Trump's election and things of that sort. And I can go into detail as we go on, but this was brought to my attention and a few other things that happened around this the same period were equally sort of strange and had an aura of this kind of occult politics. And it all seemed to be happening very quickly and all at once. And my editor at Penguin at the time, Mitch Horowitz, who's gone on to other things, he basically commissioned me to write the book about this sort of stuff that was going on. And the title was his. And it's more or less a sort of work of journalism or sort of a history in the making, as it were.
There's a you detail the history of all this stuff going back to at least the 1800s, in some cases way before that. But let's talk a little bit about the power of positive thinking and this new thought movement a little bit.
Yeah, well, what got the sort of ball rolling to do the book was soon after Trump's election. A group called the National Policy Institute, the NPI, held their annual meeting in Washington, D.C., in the Ronald Reagan building. And the head of the NPI at that time was Richard Spencer. And he's also responsible for founding the alt-right and the alternative right and a variety of other sort of far-right, ultra-conservative sort of movements. And he started this meeting. He was very enthusiastic and very excited, flushed, with Trump's victory. But he started it sort of declaring to the crowd that, hail Trump, hail our hero, we made this happen. We willed Trump into office. We made this dream our reality. And he called it their victory of the will. And if that wasn't enough to get sort of people's attention, the response the crowd had was certainly picked up by all the news media, and many people in the crowd raised their arms in Nazi salute, or what Spencer later said was a Roman salute, and this was in all the news media. This wasn't anything just on some strange website, but amidst all the other sort of reports of this, there was one piece by a fellow named Harv Bishop, who writes about New Thought. He has a blog about New Thought. And New Thought is a sort of generic name for a variety of philosophies based on the idea that thoughts create reality, that thoughts are causative. So mental science or science of mind or mind power. What grabbed Bishop's attention was that what Spencer claimed to have done is exactly the sort of thing that people who practice New Thought, want to do, make dreams reality in a very concrete sense. Now, that, you know, that could have just been some strange kind of thing, and they could have just been very excited, you know, with the victory, and, you know, let their enthusiasm go to their heads. But an odd thing connected to this and the whole New Thought idea is that Trump himself sort of grew up in an atmosphere of a kind of New Thought philosophy. Trump is a devotee of the work of the Reverend Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote The Power of Positive Thinking in the 50s, and it was a big bestseller. And when Trump was a boy, he used to go with his family to Peale's sermons, which he gave at the Marble Collegiate Church on Fifth Avenue in New York. And then later in his adult years, Trump would go there as well, and he had two of his weddings took place there. And he absorbed this philosophy of positive thinking, which is all about winning. It's all about you know, being positive, being affirmative, being forward driven, being very optimistic, not letting sort of things get in the way of you achieving you know, your goals and all this. And this is something that we know is very much in Trump's character. And this is a philosophy that he's presented in his sort of self-help books, like The Art of the Deal and other things like that. So not only so you have these kind of Trump fellow travelers somehow claiming that you know, they, you know, didn't subsequently deny that this this is, you know, what Harv Bishop had said, claiming that they had somehow willed Trump into office. Then you have a president who himself practices or at least adheres to a kind of philosophy, a view of the world that is very much part of that New Thought you know, world. And so things started to radiate out and get a bit stranger. And then in the early part of 2017, in February, after Trump had, you know, started his term, the New York Times ran an article about a speech that Steve Bannon had given to a select group of the Vatican in 2014. Now, at the time, Bannon was still part of Trump's team. He subsequently sort of lost his place. But at this time, he still had, you know, Trump's ear. And in this speech, among other things that Bannon usually talks about, and like the global Tea Party movement and, you know, fighting Islamic fascism, he name checks a fellow named Julius Evola. Now, Julius Evola was 20th century Italian esoteric philosopher who also had very far right political leanings. He tried to ingratiate himself first with Mussolini and then with National Socialism. And he's sort of a hero of the alt-right. His philosophical ideas about society and politics are sort of the intellectual kind of anchor for Spencer's ideologies and things of that sort. But he also practiced a kind of magic that was very much along the same lines of this New Thought sort of thing, and positive thinking kind of thing, the idea that through the mind, through the imagination, through visualization and, you know, a willed intent, you know, you can affect reality. And he actually tried to do this in the 1920s. He tried to have a kind of magical influence on Mussolini and his fascists. So with each step, things got stranger and stranger and stranger. And as I said earlier, eventually it sort of made its way to Russia and to other places and the internet and all sorts of strange things.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about the right, it always seems to be kind of influenced by the Christian sort of thing. So you don't normally associate magic with the right, to me anyway.
Well, I mean, there's all different, you know, I mean, the right is a large, it's a large thing. And yes, of course, you have the Christian fundamentalists who, you know, who hate the idea of any kind of magic or anything like that. And it's Satanism and all that. But if you do look at people like Umberto Eco and others who write about the relationship between sort of occultism and politics, they generally say that occultism favors tradition. This notion of a kind of traditional view of society and so on and so on, which is hierarchical and caste-like. And that's very much along, you know, sort of Christian ideas as well. So they have a certain kind of, we can say kind of almost structural similarity, even though you know, the details and some of the main ideas are very different. Yeah, I mean, that's one side of it. I mean, I don't really go into the Christian fundamentalist side of it because it isn't sort of a cult. I mean,
yeah,
actually, at the end of my earlier book, Politics and the Occult, I do talk about the Christian fundamentalist at the time. This is 2008, and the idea that if there's going to be a rise of a kind of far right spiritual politics, let's say, if not a cult, it was going to come out of there. And I mean, they're still around too. I mean, they just don't show up in the book.
Right, right. Do you think that these people, I mean, using this sort of new thought, positive thinking type of stuff, associate what they're doing with the constructs of magic?
Well, I think, you know, some people say they are. This is all taking place in the context of a world where the ideas of what's real and what isn't real and what's truth and what's false and what's reality and what's fantasy have become kind of almost interchangeable.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've entered the post-truth alternative fact world. So that's one of the themes of the book too, where that's the backdrop to something like the kind of, you know, magical stuff that we'll get onto when we sort of get onto meme magic and talking about the internet. But I mean, I think certainly people who are, well, there's certainly at least one individual who is active in Russia, a fellow named Alexander Dugin, who in his own way participates in a kind of new thought, you know, mental science, you know, wherein the mind can affect reality, which is sort of the essence of magic. He participates in that to some degree, at least by going by much of what he's written. And he's actually had some influence, I would say, and others have as well, if not shaping, at least informing some of Putin's decisions in the last few years, especially in Ukraine and Crimea. And so he, you know, believes in it to the extent that I think it's something that he feels, you know, can have some kind of, you know, active agency in the world. But it's also part of this other blend of a lot of other ideas and postmodern ideas about, you know, philosophy and truth and reality and so on. But certainly people like Julius Evola, who the alt-right looked to, and Steve Bannon, at least name-checked, did believe in this sort of thing. And as I said, practice it and try to, make things come about. Whether it works or not is another kind of thing. I mean, I don't really argue that, oh yes, this is true. I basically say, based on some experiences of my own, I don't feel compelled to, you know, categorically deny its possibility. And what's interesting to me is that it doesn't seem to be an isolated incident. I mean, so you have, you know, Spencer, you know, claiming to, you know, use some sort of magical, or at least mental, practices in order to affect the election, and this is something that you can see happening in other places as well. This is precisely what I've just said with this fellow Dugin. So it that's what struck me as things started popping up at the same time, and it seemed to be, and again, it's no conspiracy. These people, they talk to each other, but, you know, they sort of just talk to each other in the way anyone talks to each other. They're not sort of, you know, part of a secret society or anything like that.
Right.
And again, that's something that struck me as strange too, where kinds of ideas that are generally on the fringe, on the margin, seem to have somehow got sucked into the middle. And it's almost as if there was a vacuum created by Trump, you know, being elected. He somehow change the nature of things in some way, and ideas that were very strange and very far out on the fringe kind of came into the middle. You know, we know he embraces quite a few sort of conspiracy theory ideas, chemtrails, and, you know, things of that sort. So it's the idea that several different shifts and changes happened sort of at the same time that led me to feel that this was a very strange time. And that sounds banal, but it does seem to let you know, our ideas about reality have shifted.
Right. Now, one of the things you argue here is that is that Trump is basically a chaos magician. He may not know it and may not use that terminology, but you compare his behavior with that of the way chaos magic is presented.
Yeah, it's sort of his style. And I hasten to say that in no way do I want to stigmatize, you know, chaos magic or chaos magicians. Right. They're not responsible for this in any way. This is something that I just sort of noticed. But I don't think I'm the only one. In fact, this was something else that at the time, right around after the election, where at least in the kind of, you know, social media community that I'm part of, there did seem to be a sense that something had changed, that things certainly were strange, and people were kind of, you know, talking to each other and, you know, posting messages and all that. And this whole idea of chaos, somehow chaos having, you know, come up and chaos being suddenly sort of the theme, seemed to be in the air. And one of the things I noticed was that, the reason chaos magic comes into this, I don't know, I'm sort of telling the story back to front, but one of the things, the reason why chaos magic comes into this is that the way in which the alt-right were supposed to have dreamed Trump into office was through a kind of offshoot of chaos magic, which has to do with the internet. But with Trump himself, his whole style, his whole kind of way he carries himself, he's, you know, very impromptu. He doesn't like to stick to any sort of plan. He likes to be spontaneous. He likes to keep people guessing. He changes plans all the time. The hiring and firing and, you know, the enigmatic tweets and kind of gnomic messages where, you know, you're never quite sure exactly what he means, or, you know, he says outrageous things. And the whole kind of glamour, this kind of aura of sort of glamour and fantasy and power that he creates around him, which goes back to his, you know, time as a wrestling promoter and also his time as the, you know, apprentice. I mean, it's from the beginning of his career. I mean, this was something that, you know, he and sort of the Post, in New York, they kind of the scandal sheets, they kind of came to life at the same time. He was the perfect sort of material for this sort of thing, and he created this sort of, you know, legend about himself and all that. And so all of these things are sort of part of the kind of technique that or practices that chaos magic enjoys. But at this and at the same time, Trump's attitude toward reality, you know, it's very malleable. Reality is up for grabs. You know, you create your own reality. This is something that comes out of the positive thinking background. I mean, one of the fundamental lessons he learned from Norman Vincent Peale was that facts don't matter, your attitude toward facts matter. And again, this is something similar to chaos magic, where truth is something that you can adopt. There are different sorts of truths. There isn't big truth with a capital T. And in the sense that chaos magic is a kind of postmodern magic, Trump is a kind of postmodern president. And you can say this postmodern idea of the breakdown of some kind of stable absolute truth, and the acceptance of the idea that all truths are relative, that's sort of the kind of metaphysical background to all of this. And it's something I call trickle-down metaphysics, because I feel like what we're going through now is the result of a certain kind of insight, we can say. It was a devastating insight at the end of the 19th century. The philosopher Nietzsche was one of the first to recognize it, that the kind of pursuit of truth that science did, and then the equal pursuit of truth in a moral, spiritual way that Christianity engaged in. Both of these had come to the same conclusion, that there was no truth with the capital T. And that reality, that insight hadn't yet reached the lowlands. It was up in the metaphysical heights. And Nietzsche said, well, it's not going to come tomorrow, meaning the next century, the 20th century. But he said the day after tomorrow, meaning the 21st century. And it seems to me that we now, in this post-truth, alternative fact world, where, I said, reality is malleable. And again, we're seeing it from different ways: positive thinking, chaos magic, postmodernism, reality TV, that we're living in that kind of that nihilism that started, you know, back up in the metaphysical heights. But by the time it's reached us, it has a kind of banal whatever, you know, character to it. We're not that troubled by it. We just sort of accept it. And it's in that sort of atmosphere that all this sort of thing is taking place.
Okay. You also, in the book, you talk a lot about Hitler and Mussolini and the similarities, not the way that most people compare Trump to like Hitler and Mussolini, but these archetype, in a sense, of how they controlled the public and what the current administration is doing.
Well, I mean, there's a chapter on gurus and demagogues, and in which political leaders, and they all seem to share certain, you know, characteristics. The charismatic leaders, as the sociological thinker Max Weber called them, they are people who basically rule by their personality, or by their aura, or their mana. You know, this kind of sort of magic force they have in them that they can somehow exude over the people around them, in much the same ways that a guru does to a smaller group of people, or a magician does to, you know, someone, let's say, who he wants to enchant. And what I basically point out in the book is some similarities between Hitler and Mussolini in that way, and how they were able to sort of reach into these mythic levels of human personality and satisfy something that the more rational sort of political aims and purposes were unable to. And this was something that was recognized by George Orwell in the mid-30s when he was writing about Hitler. And he says something along the lines of that the German people who voted him, they didn't want only, you know, sort of higher wages and, better municipal services and trains that run on time. They wanted sort of sacrifice and tragedy and a kind of drama and a kind of heroism. And this was something that was more desirable than the more rational ends of politics and so on. And while Orwell himself is very critical of this sort of romantic, you know, mythic sort of sensibility, he also knew that it was something that was real and that it needed to be basically satisfied. And if it wasn't satisfied in some sort of positive, you know, sort of creative kind of way, it would be, you know, satisfied in some other way. And, you know, I think one of the fundamental truths about human beings is that although, you know, obviously we need food and drink and water and shelter and so on, what we also need is a sense of meaning. The sense that our lives are part of something larger than just that, just securing, you know, food and drink and water and shelter and their, you know, exaggerated contemporary equivalence in terms of, you know, greater and greater sort of material gain and wealth. And this was something that in some way, you know, Hitler and Mussolini were able to speak to. And this is something that Trump speaks to as well. He says that not everyone can think big, but people can still admire those who do think big. And this is something about Trump. He thinks big. I mean, one of the things I say in the book is that he shared with Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin as well what's called gigantomania, which is this kind of obsession with size. And if you know the sort of architectural plans that Hitler had drawn up for a Speer create, there are these, you know, cyclopean, you know, sort of buildings of colossal size and, you know, monumental proportions. And you know, many of the things that Stalin did build, you know, during his time are these huge, huge blocks of things. And Trump himself, he had plans to build the largest building in the world. That didn't come to it, but he did, you know, the biggest casino. And one of the first things he did when he was in office is he dropped the mother of all bombs, right, which is the largest non-nuclear device in Afghanistan. This is something that he shares with them. And there's a character trait that I borrow from the writer Colin Wilson, who's a British writer. And he's written a lot about crime, and he's written about a lot about the history of violence. And he talks about a character called the right man. And it could be a woman as well, but this is someone who under no circumstance will ever admit to being wrong. And they will just, you know, avoid it in any way. And actually, you know, if it comes to it, they will, you know, burst out into violent behavior just in order to avoid any admission of defeat or mistake or anything like this. And this is something that, you know, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, and Trump, too, is sharing it. There seem to be certain characteristics that he shares with these, you know, political charismatic leaders. But these are things that are also shared by these guru types. And so I look at a sort of interesting selection, I think, if I have to say so myself, because I include people like Ayn Rand, who you wouldn't immediately think of as a guru because she was a hyper-rationalist. But she's also one of the few people who Trump sort of admires and has said he read. And he felt an affinity with Howard Rourke, who's the character, the architect in The Fountainhead. She's an example of a right woman because one of the things that people quickly found, this group called The Collective that gathered around her, which is a very ironic name for a philosophy that you know, focus on individualism and selfishness. You know, she was always right, and you could never contradict her. And if you did, she burst into these, you know, enormous rages and incredible barrage of insults and things of that sort. And there's others as well. And again, there's similarity. Between some of Trump's characteristics and some of these other demagogues and that. So this is something that, you know, I think we have to watch out for. I mean, whether it's Trump or anybody else, I mean, we have to, either in our personal lives, if we're seeking a kind of deeper meaning than what everyday life can afford, but we don't quite know how to provide it for ourselves, and we may be drawn to, you know, a political movement. That's something people can, you know, join and feel, you know, something that they're part of something bigger than themselves, or, you know, some kind of spiritual kind of thing. And I'm not saying that all political movements and all gurus are bad. They're not. But we are focusing on the ones in which this kind of will to power, and control, not so much over themselves, but over others. This dominance that they seem unable to modify in any way and has to be sort of manifest in this kind of authoritarian behavior that imposes its will on everyone around it.
I in reading this book, I had no idea that Ayn Rand, like the stuff you talk about in here, I knew nothing about it. I knew who she was. I knew enough about her, but the cult-like aspects, I had no clue.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it's something that came out with this couple, Barbara Brandon and Nathaniel Brandon, who were together when they joined Rand's collective. But then Nathaniel Brandon got involved with Ayn Rand in romantic relationship, but this was all out in the open, and he was considered actually one of the second in command, and he went on to have a very successful career as a sort of motivational thinker and writer. His self-esteem was sort of his area, and this was something that was part of the Rand kind of thing. There was all these sort of dominance sort of struggles, and she was incredibly skilled, let's say, at undermining, you know, the self-esteem of, you know, people around her and all that. I mean, not to say she isn't brilliant. I mean, I'm not a Ayn Rand fan myself, although I did read The Fountainhead and I enjoyed it. In fact, at one point in the 80s and 90s, I just found myself reading through quite a bit of it, and, you know, trying to understand it. And I mean, it's, you know, there is, what do you say, there are some worthwhile things in there and so on and so on, but in general I find it rather inadequate. But she had this sort of cult following around her where people were mimicking her. You know, she smoked and she used a cigarette holder, and people around her used to, you know, smoke and use a cigarette holder, and they sort of took up her kind of aesthetic tastes, which were rather odd. You know, she didn't have time for many of the greats. I mean, she thought the German writer Thomas Mann was sort of just nothing, but she liked Mickey Spillane, and you know, yeah, he's his hard-boiled detective Mike Hammer stories and things of that sort. But you know, there was a film with Helen Mirren some years ago that was worth watching. I think it was called The Passion of Ayn Rand, which is about her relationship with Brandon, because eventually he broke it off for another woman, and this caused this, you know, rift in the collective, as it were. It all broke up, and so on. But it's a very dramatic story, and again, I put her in there because we generally think of people who get somehow involved with bad gurus who, you know, they're weak-minded, they're not rational, you know, they're too emotional or something, and so they're not able to sort of be critical. But what do you do when the guru is a hyper-rationalist, which is what Ayn Rand was? You know, she was she was about logic and money, and I sort of say it was kind of Aristotle meets Andrew Carnegie, because it's, you know, sort of about this absolute logical way of approaching life. And I mean, one of the reasons, obviously, Trump, you know, would feel an affinity with this, that she had no qualms about, you know, the virtues of, well, that was one of her books, The Virtues of Selfishness, you know, about why it's perfectly all right to make lots of money and not be altruistic and things of that sort. I mean, you have to remember that she came out of the Bolshevik Revolution. She was born in Russia, and her family were, you know, sort of the upper class. And then when the Lenin came and the Bolshevik Revolution came, you know, they were turfed out of their home, and she had to leave the school she was in. And she she was shipped out to America, was supposed to be on a visit, and she never came back. So it's understandable in some way, having felt the effects of the early days of the Soviet regime. And then later, you know, she was aware of the mass collectivization and so on. So, you can understand, but it doesn't mean you have to accept it.
Right. And one of the things I noticed about this book is that you're not attacking anyone in this book.
No, I'm not. I'm just trying to make things as clear as possible. that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be objective. I mean, I think you could tell my tone. I mean, I'm not a fan of fascism, you know, put it that
way.
But I'm not necessarily, I don't care for political correctness either. So I'm trying to walk this increasingly narrow middle line between these things in our increasingly polarized sort of world. So, I mean, I just found it fascinating. And I was also writing under pressure, because I was asked to do it, you know, at top speed and so on.
Yeah.
And so on. So it's a kind of urgency in it there. And also because I felt like this is happening now, and I wanted to capture it as clearly as I could. So no, I don't necessarily go out and attack anybody, but I try to paint as accurate a portrait of people and events as I can.
Right. Right, and I appreciate that. I thought that was great, because it's not something that's only going to appeal to one side of a demographic.
I hope that gets across. I mean, I hope you know, because it's I guess generally people may assume it's a kind of anti-Trump book, which it isn't anti-Trump. I'm no fan of Trump, but I've not been a fan of Trump, you know, for years. I remember him back in New York and you know, in the beginning, you know, in the 70s and all that. So, you know, I didn't hate him, but he's not my first choice for a good example of a human being. You know, so it's not like, you know, my own politics are involved in here. I've actually tried to keep away from all of that. I'm mostly interested in how has it happened that these sort of occult, supernatural, esoteric ideas that I've looked at in the history, kind of in the backstory of you know, or the kind of sidebar of Western culture for the last, you know, several centuries. How has it happened that this has come, you know, these things have come into the middle, and seem to have had some effect on things? And you know, that one of the things I say is I kind of tongue in cheek called Trump the singularity. Because singularity is this thing everyone's been waiting for, where everything's going to be different. And we know in physics, singularity is somewhere where the laws of physics break down, so at a black hole, or at the speed of light, or something like that. And in the New Age, the, you know, millenarian idea that, you know, there's some, you know, coming new age on its way, where everything's going to change, and that too. But I felt, and again, this was in the air at the time, after the election, that things had changed. And of course, things had changed. You know, certain behaviors, certain attitudes that were, you know, if not necessarily criminal, were generally not considered, you know, too decorous, but then they became, you know, out in the open, you know, the sort of hate crime and racism and things of that sort. And the things holding those back, you know, sort of loosened up. I guess the Overton window opened, or whatever metaphor you want to use. And yeah, as I said, it felt like, okay, history is happening now. It had caught up with me. I've been writing about sort of the history of the West for, you know, a good 20 years now through the lens of this alternative, you know, esoteric culture. Now it seems to have sort of caught up with current events. And that you know, that excited me.
Well, let's talk about the meme magic part of this whole thing. And this is interesting, because this kind of connects into the chaos magic and such.
Yeah. Well, I said earlier that the sort of magic that Spencer and the alt-right were supposed to have used to get Trump into office was something called meme magic, and that it's a sort of an offshoot of chaos magic. And briefly, chaos magic, what makes it different from sort of traditional, you know, normal magic, is that rather than stick to all the traditional kind of, you know, sort of implements, the wand and the candle and, you know, making the magic circle and getting everything just right, it has a DIY approach. It has a very creative, use your own initiative and imagination approach, where it just uses what's ever at hand. And so if you read books on chaos magic, say from the 80s, they talk about you know, using fridge magnets as kind of magical talismans, or making sort of rituals out of PJ Harvey records and things like that. So it was a kind of strange, fun kind of, again, postmodern sort of thing, where you don't stick to the tradition. You kind of just play around with everything. You take bits and pieces and you put it together yourself and see what happens. All right, but what's at hand today isn't that old school stuff. It's the internet. A meme, as we know from Richard Dawkins, it's a kind of cultural unit that, you know, gets proliferated and changed, and kind of like something like Chinese whispers, where it starts out, you know, one way and it comes out another way after changing hands quite a bit. But the magic side comes in when people who were posting stuff on sites like 4chan, they noticed, well, at least it seemed to them that something strange was happening. And what seemed to be happening was that things they were posting about seemed to bleed over into the real world. So memes, you know, pictures, images, things they were posting about, seemed to be happening, seemed to be creating events somehow in the real world. And, they pointed this out. They have rather dark kind of humor. They pointed this out by pointing to this one sort of thread they have, is Bane posting, and this was about the Batman film Dark Knight Rises. So the villain is Bane, and they posted that they liked that the beginning of the film when he's in the plane and he's, you know, he's ostensibly being taken away to prison, but actually he's in charge and he turns the tables, as it were, and so on and so on, and sends the plane crashing and gets away. And they kept posting stuff like that. And what one of them noticed was that in 2015, there was the German Wings 9525 tragedy, where the plane crashed into the Alps. And they started noticing similarities between what they had been posting about the film and what happened with the German Wings flight. And one of the things was that a town near where the plane crashed is called Bane. One of the flight crash investigators was named Bruce Robin. and things of that sort. And also that you know, the pilot seems to have crashed the plane. And okay, Bane, we know with Bane already. Bruce Robin, obviously Bruce Wayne is Batman's secret identity. Robin is his sidekick. And what seems to be the case, as Bain crashed the plane in the film, that seems to be the case with the German Ming's flight, that the pilot crashed the film. And incidentally, later on, even outside of this context, there was some other strange kind of echoes between the Bain character and Trump. And right after Trump's sort of one of his speeches where he said he's going to give power back to the people, people started posting, there was a scene in Dark Knight Rises where Bain is addressing, you know, the inhabitants of Gotham and the citizens of Gotham and telling them him that he is giving power back to the people and all that. So there seem to be even strange coincidences that the original people who noticed this weren't aware of. So that's one thing. Okay, wow. Stuff we're posting on the net seems to be bleeding over into reality. And this phenomena got christened synchromysticism. And that's basically a sort of techno rethread of C.G. Jung's notion of synchronicity. Right. And synchronicity is what we know is meaningful coincidence. This is when something that's going on in your life, in your head, whatever, then there's something out in the outer world that has no direct causal link to it whatsoever. There's no causal relation, but there's a deeply meaningful one. And it's right. Exactly what is going on in your mind as well. So if we take that and then transpose that to, rather than one person's, you know, inner world, to what has become what I think is our exteriorized imagination these days, which is the internet. So instead of something happening in my mind and then being, you know, reflected out in the outer world, what's happening on the internet is being reflected out in the outer world. And so the next step after this was, well, if this can happen by itself, can we make it happen? And this is when Pepe comes in. Pepe, or Hobson, as it were. Pepe, you know, is the creation of cartoonist Matt Fury, who I think I've said in other interviews, he's probably Matt Furious by now, because he's, you know, very, very unhappy that his creation has been, you know, appropriated by the alt-right. And he started out as a very sort of innocuous, just amphibian slacker. But as happens in the internet world, once you launch a meme, you don't have any control over it. And he sort of hopped over to the dark side. And what had happened is some of these Trump supporters, some of these 4chan users who were these kind of internet brats who, you know, hated the politically correct world and all of that kind of thing, they just started taking Pepe's image and using him to, you know, express their, you know, their spite and their anger and at the establishment and so on and so on and so on. And what sort of got the ball going was there was one post of Pepe looking over the Mexican border and, you know, kind of, you know, the whole Trump's wall idea. And then Trump picked it up and he starts posting images of Pepe and him or himself as Pepe and so on and so on. And Pepe is one of the deplorables, you know, this kind of meme that got posted after Hillary Clinton called, you know, Trump and his kind of gang a bunch of deplorables. And so they sort of took over the whole idea of the film, The Expendables, and so on and so on. So the stuff started to grow and mushroom and all that. And the idea was that given in chaos magic, you can use anything as a kind of magical talisman, which is an object that carries your will and your intention, the magical energies. Pepe became that. And the whole idea was to keep posting, you know, more and more images of him up there, and with the intent of, you know, helping Trump's election. And the next thing that happened was that they started to think that they were getting some kind of approval for the posts. And this came in the form of, well, what happens when you post it on 4chan is that you're anonymous. You don't have a name, but you have a number. You're given an 8-digit number. And what was happening was when people were posting something about Trump or, you know, or Pepe or the alt-right or whatever, they would get, you know, double numbers or triple numbers or even quadruple numbers in one of these 8-digit numbers. And this seemed to be some kind of approval. And people were betting, you know, whether they were going to get a double or a triple or whatever. And approval from whom? You know,
yeah.
what some kind of intelligence on the internet seemed to be approving what was going on. It was, you know, and of course it was half tongue in cheek for some people. Some people took it seriously. But the next kind of notch in this was when someone noticed that Pepe, who was a frog, was very similar to an ancient Egyptian frog-headed deity. Now, if you know the ancient Egyptians, they had many, you know, theriomorphic deities, which means animal formed. And so they had many deities that, you know, it's a cow, you know, there's a cat and so on and so on. So one of them was a frog-headed deity. And his name was Keck. Now, Keck comes into this strange synchronistic puzzle because the same people who were posting on 4chan, they were all sort of devotees of the World of Warcraft game. And they found that whenever they wanted to post LOL, you know, because they found something funny on the game, because I guess they played it online, somehow it wouldn't post as LOL, it would post as K-E-K. And this, strangely enough, turned out to have something to do with the Korean language, which is another little odd kind of rivulet of coincidence in here, too. And so they gave up after a while trying to post, you know, type LOL and just went with K-E-K. So whenever they found anything funny, they would just write K-E-K, Keck. They would burst out kecking, as I say in the book. And so the two things came together. So suddenly, you know, some term they've been using all along, they've been saying Keck to each other for a while. Suddenly it turns out that Pepe, who they're posting about and getting the approval, you know, from about, he's an avatar of an ancient Egyptian frog-headed deity named Keck. And so it just seemed, how could this be, you know, how could this be happening? How could this be possible? And people started to think of these, you know, again, half tongue-in-cheek, half seriously, who knows? And maybe it starts out as a joke and it becomes serious. I mean, that's another element in this book where, you know, something that starts out as a fake becomes the real thing. And so it was supposed to have been through posting, you know, all these images of Pepe and then getting the approval from, I guess, the god of chaos. I mean, that's the other thing, too. Keck is the god of chaos. So they're practicing a kind of chaos. Again, they're practicing a kind of chaos magic. And they're getting approval from a god of chaos for doing it. And what's the one word that you associate with Trump's, you know, administration? I would say chaos. Yeah. At least in the beginning, that was something. It's like, you know, the hiring and firing, he changing his mind, you know, all the enigmatic tweets, as I said, and all keeping everything up in the air. So, again, it's the kind of thing where if you just pull one thread, it all starts to, I mean, it's the opposite of unraveling. If you sort of follow the thread, you get to this ball of yarn that, you know, seems very strange, but when they all add up together, they seem to be connected. And as I say, similar events were taking place over in Russia, where another kind of chaos magic was going on.
Well, it seems like the Russian stuff, though, was a little more planned out. Like they were more focused on what was going on, whereas the stuff here in the U.S. was sort of, well, more chaotic.
Hmm. Well, it's been going on longer there in Russia, where it's something that more or less started up, let's say, you know, with Trump or just before Trump's election. I forget exactly when the alt-right sort of came into being. It had been sort of, you know, hovering around for a few years. I mean, Spencer had a career, you know, in these areas leading up to his becoming a celebrity for a while. But in Russia, it's been going on for quite some time. Almost, you know, throughout the whole of Putin's, his reign, you know, want to say, because he's been, you know, there for such a long time now. And there's sort of two different phases, we can say. I mean, the first phase was this, not so much a cult, but very much along the lines of this kind of postmodern idea of creating one's own reality, which is, you know, based on fundamentally a kind of cynicism about the notion of truth and fact and all of that. And there was a fellow named Vladislav Surkov, who was known as a political technologist, which was the term they used for what we would call sort of a PR man or a kind of spin doctor. But one of the things that Putin did, the first things he did when he got into power, when he was elected, after he was, you know, he was sort of made prime minister, then he became president when Yeltsin stepped down, and then he was elected, he gained control of the state media, television and radio and everything else. And that was how most people in Russia got any kind of news, any kind of information, you know, about what was going on anywhere. There was a sort of thin sort of segment of the, you know, the population who have access to kind of internet outside of the kind of state controlled area. Basically what he did was he sort of created this kind of electronic bread and circuses, where the idea was to keep people happy and people, you know, in the early days he was, you know, Putin worked in reforms and economic reforms and things of that sort. And the standard of living went up, you know, he got into power, you know, Russia was in free fall, you know, the ruble collapse in 98, and, you know, it had already gone through the whole chaos of the collapse of the Soviet Union, so on and so on. When he got into power, he sort of, you know, the whole idea was him bringing stability. And Surkov's job was to create something that was known as managed democracy. And fundamentally, that was to create a kind of society that had the appearance of democracy, but was actually, you know, managed. It was actually, you know, all kind of scripted. And one of the things he did was that he would sort of create sort of fake oppositional political parties, and then have them go through long debates and you know, things of that kind of sort, in order to give sort of the appearance of a kind of real political debate going on. But, you know, again, everything was scripted, and in the end, it would have been the whatever result that was ordered from on down, you know, from on high down, that would have happened. But he was a very interesting character. I mean, Surkov himself was, you know, this hyper cynical postmodern character who wrote these sort of ultra postmodern novels. But then he, you know, he denied that he actually wrote them. But there was one that Almost Zero that he almost certainly wrote. He wrote a foreword to it, but he almost certainly wrote it as well. But at the same time, he funded sort of ultra-conservative religious groups who were burning the kind of, you know, books he was writing.
Right.
So he would fund a kind of very transgressive art show somewhere, and then he would fund a very conservative church group to go and picket, you know, the art show and things of that sort. And everything was PR. I mean, he himself said to have any kind of real belief is a handicap in this world. You have to be a chameleon. You have to be able to move around. And he was able to do this through a variety of ways. There's a wonderful book by Peter Pomerantsev. I think it's called Everything is True, or Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, something along those lines. And it's about his years working in the media in Russia during this time, when that was the whole idea. The news had to be something that was very entertaining. And you had a wide berth of what you could do in many ways, and the stranger the better. But in other ways, it was, you know, absolutely constrained, because you couldn't say, the message couldn't be anything other than, you know, the party message as it was. And this was when Putin's party, United Russia, was becoming, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and so on. So that went on until about sort of 2013 or 14, until the sort of the Ukraine episode, in which Surkov actually stage managed part of that as well, sort of inventing kind of local insurgents who were most likely really Russian, you know, soldiers, right, and things of that sort. And he talked about what he called the nonlinear war. And he's one of the ones that's, you know, sort of pioneered the kind of cyber warfare stuff that, you know, we talk about today. And the whole idea that you could have a military war, but then it could be a war of propaganda, but then a cyber war where you would be sending false information, you know, much more easily today through the internet and things of that sort. So much of the sort of thing that, you know, people are up in arms about, the possibility that, you know, Russian intervention and all of that, I'm not saying he was directly involved in that intervention, but he was kind of the one who sort of introduced this notion of this nonlinear war, where there actually were no sides. You know, it was sort of like you could kind of infiltrate all aspects of the war, and in many ways there wouldn't be kind of people fighting against each other. It just would be a kind of chaos that was stage managed. But he drops out of the picture because after a while the population started to get tired of the kind of bread and circuses. And usually when that happens, when you get tired of all this false reality, because most people knew that it wasn't real, but they also, their standard of living was much higher than it had ever been. And the kind of cynicism that Surkov embodied was kind of just kind of accepted throughout the culture a great deal. I'm not saying everyone, but in general, there was a kind of fatigue from trying to, you know, do anything, more than that. But then a kind of fatigue with that set in. And Putin sort of changed his tactic, which he turned around, and you can see in the speeches in more recent times, where he's presenting Russia as the upholder of traditional values. He's presenting Russia as the upholder of traditional religious, you know, spiritual values against the decadent West, the decadent, hyper-liberal, anybody can do anything, you know, pretty much West, where the notion of rights and, you know, individuals' rights have just kind of proliferated into, you know, some kind of strange overdrive. And this is where people like this fellow Julius Evola, who I mentioned earlier, come in some way, because he's an advocate of sort of esoteric philosophy that's known as traditionalism with the capital T. And it, in the kind of general talk about things, it usually gets the notion of traditional values and traditionalism kind of get blended together, and they're related, but they're not the same thing. This fellow Alexander Dugin, who's some of his ideas have reached Putin, is someone who's very much behind the whole idea of traditional values, and he is a traditionalist as well. And so there's a kind of attempt to revive this notion of Holy Russia, which is an idea of Russia that's sort of pre-Bolshevik, and it goes back to the 16th century, and the idea of Russia being the third Rome after the original Rome. And then there was, after that fell, there was Constantinople. And it was from Constantinople itself that Russia got the Orthodox Christianity. That was where it got it from. And then when Constantinople fell, in the mid 1400s to the Turks, then Moscow was considered to be the third Rome. And it had this, there was always this sense in Russian history, if you read Russian history, they always talk about the Russian idea. There was some peculiar mission that Russia had in the history of the world in some way. And it's linked to this idea of a kind of Christian civilization. But it's the Orthodox Christianity is a lot more mystical in its basis than sort of Roman Catholicism. And it has a very eschatological, millenarian aspect. There's the whole sense of this new world coming, this new age coming. And so in a way, Putin is kind of, he's lining himself up with this kind of sensibility. And in one of his speeches a couple of years ago, He gives this kind of reading list to his regional governors, and on it are philosophers from this fantastic period in Russian culture called the Silver Age, which is sort of the last decade of the 19th century into just before the Bolsheviks, just after the revolution as well. And people like the philosopher Vladimir Soloviev, who's this sort of, he's very acute, philosopher, critical thinker, but he also has this vision of this kind of global civilization, in which there would be a kind of brotherhood of man and so on and so on. And there is a kind of strange version of that in some of the ideas that Putin is kind of putting into his speeches. And one of the places he's kind of getting it from is from this fellow Dugin.
And you compare Dugin to Rasputin a little bit too, don't you?
Well, I mean, he's been called that. He's not really that. I mean, but it's a good, you know, it's a good headline. You know, Putin's Rasputin. I mean, you know, who's not going to say that? Who's not going to say that? But he's not quite that. Although, if you read what he says, I mean, he's very cagey, Dugin, because he says, "Oh no, I have no influence." And other times he's kind of said, you know, the man who's, you know, his ideas have, you know, guided Putin and so on and so on. And there's even times when he said, you know, the more Putin becomes like me, Dugin, the more he becomes Putin, which is, you know, contrary to most popular ideas, you know, Rasputin didn't hypnotize anyone in any of that kind of thing. He was a healer, and he did seem to have remarkable kind of healing powers. But he was sort of kind of a loose cannon and so on and so on. It's similar in the sense that, Dugin is much more of an intellectual. Rasputin wasn't an intellectual. He was sort of a holy man. Yeah. But it's just that he has these very strange ideas, and he does. If you ever seen any sort of videos of him on YouTube, and there are some, and there is, I mean, the BBC, I watched one, there was a BBC reporter who interviewed him a few years ago, and you see images where he has this chaos star in the background, and this is this eight-pointed star that's often associated with chaos magic, which itself comes from a series of novels about a character called the Eternal Champion by the British writer Michael Moorcock. And those novels are about this eternal war between, you know, chaos and order and all this kind of thing. So, Putin, I think, you know, I'm no expert on whatsoever, but I think he's a very cagey, strategically minded individual. And one of the things that Russia has needed in the last, decades was some kind [S2] Yeah. [S1] Of sense of itself again. And I think that's what he's been trying to do. And, at the same time, I mean, it doesn't hurt that Trump is, shaking up, the game board a lot too. And, he's whatever his attitude towards NATO and so on and so on. But one of the big ideas that Dugin has is this notion of what's called Eurasia. And this is the notion that Russia isn't a backward cousin of Europe and never can't quite ever catch up to it. It has its roots in its Asian kind of history with the Tartars and the Mongols and all that. And what's happening now is that it's beginning to come into its own as a new planetary global civilization. That's new. It's going to somehow reabsorb territories that were part of the Soviet Union and also make alliances with other sort of Asian countries, and is going to rise up as this new power in the 21st century, so that there can't just be a unipolar world in which sort of the West is the only sort of superpower. He talks a lot about a multipolar world, and he has a fundamental idea that there's this kind of, as I just mentioned, this eternal battle between, order and chaos. Well, Dugin has a similar idea that there's an eternal battle between what he calls the seafaring nations, the Atlanticists, which is the United States and the UK and, I guess, the NATO countries, and the people of the heartland, the mother of all continents. And this is Eurasia, and this is the single largest landmass on the planet. And there's some kind of conflict, and you can even see there's an elemental conflict there, where you have the fluid, changing, shifting world of the maritime peoples, and then you have the solid, eternal, stable mass of Eurasia. And this, and he's saying this is there's some kind of final conflict is coming in some way between these two things, or it should come, for him. So, I mean, how much is bluster? How much is, saying outrageous things? It's hard to say, because you see, himself is an actor as well. He himself is a kind of character. So he's given to that. He's given to this kind of political street theater. I mean, throughout his career, he was involved in a variety of different strange far right, extreme kind of groups, the National Bolshevists and things of that sort. And it's very much almost like, the Monty Python, the raving loony party or something like that, But again, it's the kind of thing where it starts out as a joke, but it can become real. And again, that's one of the themes of the book, where the simulacra becomes the actual thing.
And you also, one last thing I want to get to here is that you also talk about, and I don't know if I'm saying this right or not, egregores.
Egregore, yeah, I don't know.
And as well as tulpas being a part of this whole thing, along with Pepe.
these are two ideas that come out of the Western sort of esoteric tradition. And they're two examples of what we can call thought forms. And as we said at the early part of the show, one of the central ideas in New Thought and positive thinking and chaos magic is that thoughts are things. Thoughts can affect reality. And an egregore is a kind of thought form. It's a kind of being that's brought into existence by a group who kind of devote their attention and their imagination and their will to it. And it's a kind of group mind that grows up among these people. And then after a while, it can take on a life of its own. And then it becomes something that grows to dominate the people who brought it into existence. And there's different examples in, sort of the history of politics from this occult point of view, you can point to this, the kind of thing that, say, with, National Socialism and that sort of thing, where this kind of unitive kind of mind grows up out of all the rallies and the yearnings and the romantic, kind of visions of Hitler and also, of the German people. A tulpa is something that is generally, it's a thought form itself, but it's generally created by one person. The examples I give in the book come from there was a magician in the early 20th century named Dion Fortune, and she was one of the greats from the classical period of the 20th century magic. And she tells a story of how when she was practicing visualization, when she was practicing this kind of meditation in which you visualize things more and more vividly until they take on a kind of 3D reality outside of your imagination, that she had visualized the wolf, and then she did it so well that it came into being itself. And she visualized it going out the window, going out, her room and all that. And long story short, other people had encountered the wolf as well. And she was told that she had to somehow absorb it, dissolve it, and bring it back in. And so she tells the story of how she did that. And the other woman I talk about is the French explorer Alexandre David Neal, who wrote a remarkable book called Magic and Mystery in Tibet. And she was one of the earliest women to go to Tibet, or European women to go there, to Lhasa. And she tells the story of how, while she was there, a monk taught her how to create a tulpa, how to create a thought form. And she made one of a monk. And this happened over time. And she said at some point, though, it took on a life of its own, like Dion Fortune's wolf did. And it was three-dimensional. Other people could see it. She could even feel it when it walked by and all that. And just as with the wolf, she eventually had to, learn how to dissolve it and to, take it back into herself. And both of these women were, exceptional women with remarkable mental powers of imagination and will. And both of them, it was quite a struggle in order to do this. And one of the things I ask in the book is that, well, can we think of Pepe the Frog as a kind of egregore? Is he kind of this kind of electronic midway, real, unreal kind of character who sort of took on a kind of life of his own and somehow drew upon energies from some other plane, who knows, again, yeah. I'm asking, I don't know. I'm just asking the question. I'm not saying it is true, but I'm wondering, I keep an open mind to these kinds of things. But maybe more to the point, is Trump a tulpa? Is Trump a thought form that somehow come into existence? And one of the reasons I ask this question is again, it's this whole idea that we live in this time where the barrier between the real and the represented, the simulation and the reality, the actual world and the world of the internet or the world of the television, seem to have broken down. I mean, the most popular thing on television for a long time now has been reality, yeah. Reality TV. There's even a television shows about people watching reality TV television shows. So we have it even like doubly, self-referential. And again, Trump himself was a reality TV celebrity for many years on The Apprentice. And what kind of role did he play? He was someone in power. He was the boss. He could hire and fire. And he sat there with his big suit and the big tie and all that sort of thing. And so, half jokingly, I say, well, we've been putting a lot of reality into the television for a very long time. Doesn't it stand to reason that it would get kind of crowded in there and something will have to pop out? And isn't that like that horror film, The Ring, with the video where something comes out of the television screen? Well, I just wonder, has Trump popped out of the, reality TV world and now is occupying this, the same position that he had more or less when he was a reality TV celebrity? And one of the things I point to, and again, this is half tongue in cheek, but there was this is in a footnote. There was a book written in the 40s by a fellow named Siegfried Krakauer, who was a German sort of sociologist, and he was part of the what was known as the Frankfurt School. He was also part of the New School for Social Research in New York. But he wrote a book called From Caligari to Hitler, and his thesis was that all these wonderful films, these German expressionist films that were made sort of prior to the rise of National Socialism, like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or Fritz Lang's Dr. Mabuse films, and Fritz Lang again also with Metropolis, they all seem to have this kind of leader figure, this kind of mastermind, you know, who's behind everything and controlling everything. And he wondered if these films somehow primed the German population for the Führer, you know, for Hitler to come to power. Somehow it had, and I half wondered, okay, well, did Trump's years as the, you know, on The Apprentice, did they somehow prime some part of the American public for him to come across as that archetype, that come across as that kind of leader archetype? Because he certainly plays up to that. You know, he certainly, you know, he, as I said, going back to, you know, sort of seeing echoes between he and Hitler and Mussolini, a lot of the, you know, the kind of impromptu, the kind of sudden decisions, you know, the sort of, you know, just sort of, you know, he doesn't really care about, you know, social kind of politeness and so on. He shoots from the hip and all this kind of thing. And he's an exceptional character. And this is another trait that these individuals all share.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thank you for spending so much time with us. The book is called Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. Where is the best place for people to follow you? I'm sure this is available everywhere.
Yeah, it should be. I have my own website. It's just garylockman.co.uk, and you can find information about me and my books there. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. And yeah, I mean, you know, you can order it online or maybe at the bookshops. I don't know these days. Most things are online these days. But yeah, please do. And I hope you enjoy it.
And I highly recommend it. What do you have next on your plate?
I'm actually working on a book about Russia now.
Ah.
I'm working on a follow-up about this whole idea of this revival of the idea of Holy Russia. Because again, that just seems fascinating to me. I mean, I'm not really a politically minded person. I mean, I'm aware of it, but it's not really my focus, and certainly not so much current events. And I've kind of found myself doing this now, but doing the research for Dark Star, I just saw so much there about Russia, and it seemed that it's timely too. You know, it seems to be in the air. So yeah, I'm working on that one now.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Gary.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And a special thanks to all of my Patreons, and particularly those pledging $10 or more for the extra support: Super Inframan, Andy McNamara, William Lovelace, Mark Brady, Allison Cook, Craig Cisneros, Donna Beveridge, Sasha Lorg, Christopher Vaughn, Robert Groom, Scott Morris Everett, Chris Elmquist, Russell Wilcoxon, Patricia Gaiaquinta, Matthias Sumby, and John Eddy. Thank you all so much. All right, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I highly recommend the book. It's a very interesting read, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. And he writes interesting stuff. So hopefully we'll have him back sometime soon, because there's some other books I want to talk to him about. All right. To take you out, we're going to hear some Eliza Rickman. Coming off Oh You Sinners, this is Devil's Flesh and Bones. We'll see you next week.
You saw a dirty one. Have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.